Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo companies for shipments to rural Alaska for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com.
Line One brings you this special presentation of Out North's Mental Health Mosaics. Welcome to Mental Health Mosaics from Out North, which is located on the unceded traditional lands of the Dena'ina people in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm Ann Hillman. On this episode, we're talking about racism and mental health, both racism within mental health systems and how racism in general affects mental health. We're talking about really painful stuff like police brutality and misdiagnosis, so please care for yourself. Later in the episode, we'll also get into ways to shift the mental health system to start to solve the problems by talking with psychiatrist and professor Dr. Ruth Shim. We're starting this episode with another poem from MC Mahogany Magnetic, an African-American trans woman poet and activist that speaks directly to police brutality, white supremacy, and pain. She puts all of these issues into the context of her lived experience with mental illness. Here's Mahogany.
The title of this poem is No Justice, George, No Peace, Brianna. Clearly written in 2020. Where are you now that George Floyd has died? Are you down and ready to ride? Take no more with your last breath. Let the system burn till there's nothing left but the hardcore reality that Black Lives Matter. Water cooler, convo filled with chatter, calling into question your humanity. Like a grudge, Corona got a grip on sanity. Got folks sick, tired, hot, bothered, and sad. Everybody and their mama all pissed off and mad about a Black woman shot and killed in her own house. Don't act like you don't know Breonna Taylor's who I'm talking about. So yeah, don't worry about that bucket of water. Remember the centuries of genocide and slaughter. Superiority complex can be unlearned. And so what? The roof is on fire. Let it burn. Give them no choice but to listen and respect our voice. Get your hands out my pocket. No means no. We said stop it. Murderers getting paid on administrative leave, promoted for using their knees to choke hope out of the people. All lives matter. Come on, man. That ish ain't equal. Tell me what's making a difference supposed to look like. Matt struck fireworks in broad daylight. No longer satiated, refused to be placated until the killing of our people cease. If there's no justice for George and Breonna, there will be no peace.
When we were talking about this episode of Mosaics and we were talking about, you know, mental health and oppression, like what made you think this poem, made you associate it with mental health?
Right. Well, you know, I think this episode is not just oppression, but we're talking about white supremacy.
Heck yeah.
We're talking about structural, institutionalized, systemic, internalized racism. There's oppression. There's class issues. This, you know, police brutality. Some serious things going on, right? But we must talk about these things. And they, like, greatly affect every aspect of our lives. Racism and white supremacy are so invasive in not just our lives, access to healthcare, access to wealth, access to, you know, to housing and you know, treated fairly in the courts. But it impedes on our own lives, you know? When you go home and, like, you know, you're trying to mind your business, you know, just chilling, but you got to, you know, watch, you know, catch the news clip or whatever. And it's just, like, hard, you know, you can't, like, just come home and take racism off of you, right? You just can't go home and get rid of white supremacy because there's no food in the refrigerator, you know? Why you don't have any food? It's not always from a lack of trying. Is the fact that, well, you can't get a job because they're not hiring Negroes today, period. And that's that. And so it's like one hurdle after another, one challenge after another. It impedes on our personal relationships and the way we interact with one another. Especially when we think about and talk about internalized racism, right? So in this poem, I talked about superiority complex can't be unlearned. Well, just as, you know, European white Americans have been able to adopt this attitude that this superiority over people, you know, as people of color have often, like, you know, internalized racism where we, like, inferior. Another word that I don't use, but I can't say it, is minority, right? There's nothing minor about me, period. End of discussion on that. But to say that I'm minor, I'm internalizing this, like I'm less than, and I'm not. So, and that plays into it, right? Internalized racism can, you know, make me like straighten my hair, perm my hair when my hair is like naturally curly, right? It's kinky and stuff. Internalized racism is like, you see it in like many, on the continent of Africa, you go to African stores. I haven't seen here in Anchorage. Yes, I have. I've seen them every place I've gone, and going to African stores to get traditional African food. There's always skin lightener there on the shelf somewhere, you know, right? So, you know, to lighten our skin, to be more passable and you know, things. Or one of the things that I remember like learning too is that how you interact with the police. Don't look them in the eye, you know? You know what I'm saying? Because you don't want to be confrontational, you know? And at one point in time in American history, you know, it's like if, you know, I'm walking down the street and there's some good, you know, old white folks walking, I had to like, you know, step off to the side, let them have the sidewalk. Those were the days we was living in, you know, when we talk about segregation.
And you're not that old.
I'm not that old. I'll be 46 in January. Ooh, but I am that old, right? I am that old because I have my parents' memories and their experiences. I have my grandmother's memories that I know of, right? Maybe things will start getting out of reach when I no longer have people like that to connect to, but then I still have the history books. And I love history. So for me to, like, you know, read about the past, I'm like experiencing this thing now. You know, one more thing I'll say about racism that's important too, is that it's a weapon that anyone can pick up and use at any given time. White folks do not have the monopoly on racism. Do not own a monopoly on racism. And I'm like, golly, I get into it with some of my own black folks, my friends and everything. They be like telling some old racist jokes about Chinese people or Japanese people. It's like, no, that's not cool, period. Under no circumstances. We just, because we've internalized racism, we experience oppression, don't mean we gotta turn around and treat other people like crap, period. Don't do it, you know? So those are conversations that need to be had too, because we, none of us are absolved from using this. But yeah, racism is white supremacy, it's a beast.
In your treatment for mental illness, have you experienced within the mental health system people being white supremacists or being racist? Or just pushing ideas on you that...
Yeah, I mean, definitely received some stuff from patients that I was hospitalized with. You know, that's one thing that we talk about mental health and being hospitalized. Oftentimes we talk about what it's like, you know, with the doctors and nurses, and have been treated certain kinds of ways with them based on... And it's difficult for me to say... why people are discriminating against me sometimes. I don't know if it is because of race or because of gender. Sometimes it's both. But I know it when I felt it, and I've had experienced quite a bit of that. And I've been in a lot of different hospitals, you know, Staten Island, Atlanta, Georgia, here in Anchorage. I've been to everyone but API. And I've been treated like, you know, sometimes in very... disrespectful ways, neglectful ways, dismiss. I remember there was a time where I had a manic episode. I was suicidal after being, I don't know what to say. I want to say it was an attack was too strong, but this white man basically, like, he asked me, was I a woman or a man? And I says, like, I have a dress on. I have these nails and I have this lipstick on. I had black lipstick on that day. And he grabs my head and he twists my head. So I can't tell your lipstick apart from your face because you're black, you know. And then as I was moving away, he, you know, moves to like lift up my dress. And so when I called the Alaska State Troopers about it, this was like 2017 around Labor Day. And when I called the trooper, it was like, yeah, I'm going to look, you know, go check this out. Now, my license has been changed, you know, to reflect that I'm female. My name is like legally changed and everything. So the officer was like, yes, ma'am, blah, 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 blah. So he goes and talks to the other people to get their side of the story. So, but when he comes back and he's talking to me, he's like misgendering me. What? You know, he's talking to me in a different tone. He says, well, this is a non-reportable crime. I'm like, what's a non-reportable crime? You know? Basically, you're telling me what happened to me, a black woman, is not worth you filling in some funky boxes. What happened to me wasn't worth that. So when I'm hospitalized, you know, and I'm telling, you know, the doctors and the nurses and the counselors my experience of how, like, you know, this manic attack, this psychotic episode, this suicidal ideation stems from, you know, how I was treated, you know, to racially discriminated against at Humpies, racially, you know, attacked by this man here. That plays into why I'm there in the hospital. Can they empathize with that? No. Like, well, we don't know what to tell you, but you should definitely try this medication, see how you feel tomorrow. You know, that's just what it leads to, because, you know, many of these doctors and physicians are not people of color, so they don't know what these experiences are like, you know, saying it's like how that actually factors into depression and mania and panic and anxiety attacks, you know. So, yeah, that's like, you know, a major part. But like I started to say, too, one of the things they don't talk about is when you are hospitalized, you also are in there with other people who are, you know, going through some things. However, they may have mental health issues, but they're still bringing themselves there. They're still bringing their racist ideas. They're still bringing their transphobic ideas to the group, their homophobic ideas to the group, to the meetings, to the setting. And it's been taught, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, the counselors that do the work are like setting these ground rules and stuff. But every now and then someone breaks these rules and says something very hurtful to another person, you know. Why are you trying to get care and treatment? And it's like, I just want to get well. I don't want to have to like deal with no racism and transphobic stuff right now, you know? Like, can I just be, you know, a patient? But yeah, that's my poem in the essence, though, to speak to that and to talk about, you know, specifically this poem speaks to, you know, the deaths of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. So we're talking about police brutality here, and we're talking about systems, and we're talking about like over what, 400 or 500 years of this captivity, like, and it's living memory. You know, saying my grandmother, grandparents can tell me what it was like, you know, growing up as children in sharecropping. That's, you know. It's not that far away.
That was MC Mahogany Magnetic talking about poetry, racism, and mental health. Mahogany's experiences are unfortunately not unique. Discrimination has a direct effect on mental health, and there is discrimination and racism within the mental health system. To put Mahogany's experiences in a larger perspective, I reached out to Dr. Ruth Shim, a Black psychiatrist who's working to fix these problems.
My name is Ruth Shim, and I am a psychiatrist. My official titles right now are that I am the Luke and Grace Kim Professor in Cultural Psychiatry at the University of California, Davis, in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. I'm also the Associate Dean of Diverse and Inclusive Education in the School of Medicine at the University of California, Davis. And so those are that's my day job. That's what I've been working on for the last couple of years. And and I've been a psychiatrist for about going on nearing 20 years now. The work that I do has been really rewarding, and I've managed to see a lot of kind of the field of mental health, see a lot of what's wrong with mental health, particularly in this country. And that has led to me trying to come up with solutions for how to fix some of the problems in the system as it relates to mental health.
I really appreciate that about your work, that you're not just like, this is wrong and this is wrong, but this is where we go from here.
Yeah.
How did you end up in psychiatry to begin with?
You know, it's interesting. I, for whatever reason, since I was really young, have always been interested in mental health and psychiatry. And I have no idea why, but I always tell people when I was like 10 or 11, I would read Time magazine articles about people with mental illnesses. And I was always like, I remember there was a fascinating article in Time about clozapine, one of the drugs that treats schizophrenia. And I read it cover to cover and I found it so interesting and I was really young. And so I don't know where that interest comes from, but it has always been there for some reason. You know, as I have gotten older, clearly I've encountered lots of family members and friends that have struggled with mental health problems and substance use disorders. And so that kind of increased my interest. Especially the fact that how those illnesses in my family and friends, how they were kind of not discussed all the time, how people kind of avoided the topic. And so that really led me to kind of strongly want to do something in the mental health world.
What do you think it was about being like doing psychiatry that really just resonated with you?
I think that It's just to turn that question a little bit, you know, I think that people have a really strong perception of what a psychiatrist is. There's like an image of a psychiatrist, and often it is like an older white man on a couch, you know, talking to a patient in his office. And that is kind of the image of what a psychiatrist is. And I just felt like there was more, there's more for what psychiatry should be. And so I was kind of drawn to the idea that I wanted to change the perception of psychiatry. And I wanted to change how people view that field. And really, because I think I was seeing so much mental health problems everywhere, you know, like everyone is dealing with mental health problems. Everyone is dealing with substance use disorders. This is like pervasive. And I didn't feel, I felt like the images of what a psychiatrist was were so removed from the day-to-day reality of what regular people are dealing with. And I really wanted to kind of think about how can we make this more accessible for people. So that's one of the reasons I went into psychiatry, because I wanted people to kind of look at me and say, oh, this is somebody that I could go and see and talk to about my mental health problems. And maybe it's not like super expensive, and maybe it's not so hard to access services. And maybe it's more about like trying to solve regular everyday problems that people have as it relates to mental health.
I like your vision of what psychiatry could be.
Yeah, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. But I'm really encouraged, because there's a lot of young people coming into the field that feel mm-hmm. just like me, and a lot of people that have looked at the problems that we see in our society, the ways that so many people are having mental health issues, and that they're not being addressed, and how it's an equity issue in particular, how certain populations have less access to mental health services and substance use services, and how just the very nature of being oppressed and marginalized in society leads to mental health problems, just by navigating the world when you're being discriminated against or when racism occurs. And there are more and more people going into the field of psychiatry now that understand those things really clearly, when that was never something that was highlighted in traditional psychiatry training. So I'm really excited and hopeful for the future, because I do think the field and the face of psychiatry is changing.
That's really exciting to hear, because I mean, I fully admit that I come in with the same biases of thinking, you know, you picture the New Yorker cartoon. And
exactly.
Yeah, I don't view that as helpful. Whereas like I talk to all these peer support specialists who have lived it, you know, and I'm like, oh yeah, you're the one I want to talk to. Like,
exactly. And that's the thing, you know, the other perception, that old perception of psychiatry is pretty elitist.
Yeah.
It's this idea that only certain people have expertise and everybody else should not be involved in the care or management of people with mental health issues. And so there is no space in that old model for peer specialists. There's no space for psychologists. There's no space for social workers. And a large number of psychiatrists are still kind of like fighting other fields around prescribing rights, as if this is like the most critical issue that we have in the field of mental health. It's, you know, people are not able to access mental health services. And so if there are models that are trying to increase access, I don't understand why we spend so much time arguing and kind of excluding people from providing services and providing support, which is what many psychiatrists do, at least many psychiatrists of old do. And I again want to point out that I do think that coming into the field now and moving us in a new direction, there's a much more inclusive model for how psychiatry should be provided. There's much more thought that it should be done in teams, not this individual provider sitting on his couch waiting for people to come in the office, but that teams, including peer specialists and psychologists and social workers, and all number of people work together to provide more population level care to people with mental health problems.
It's exciting to hear that you see that evolution happening. So let's take a step back and talk about where we were before we could talk about where we're going. I was interested in talking to you because you are so open about talking about the inequities in mental health care and how we got there. And I was wondering if you could talk about that, please.
Yeah. So the reason that I'm so interested in inequities is because the same as we talked about before, like the training that I got, and I got a great psychiatry training and I had a great psychiatry training experience, but that training involved, providing the evidence-based treatments that we learn about to different populations. And I trained at Emory University and one of the interesting things about Emory in Atlanta is that the training sites, there's two separate training sites. One site is at Emory University Hospital, which is located distinctly in the suburbs of Atlanta, in the richest part of Atlanta. And then the other training site is Grady Memorial Hospital, which is the poorest part, located in the city, in downtown Atlanta, in the poorest part of the city. And so you had these two sites and residents and trainees would rotate at both of these sites. And what I started noticing kind of very early on in my training is that I'm the same provider and I'm doing the same thing. So I'm providing the exact same treatments and I'm talking to people exactly the same way and I'm prescribing the exact same recommendations and we're doing all of the same things around caring for these patients. But the outcomes for the people at Emory University Hospital were completely different from the outcomes of people at Grady Memorial Hospital. And the difference was people, for instance, with depression, when I would see them at Emory University Hospital, I would treat them and we would prescribe medications and we would do therapy and they would get better. And then I would rotate at Grady Memorial Hospital and do the exact same thing. And they would not get better. And I couldn't fundamentally understand, I wanted to understand what is happening here. Again, I'm no different. And the environments are different, but like, is this, as many people have posited, is there something about the population? Is there something intrinsic about the people at Grady Memorial Hospital versus the people at Emory University Hospital? I couldn't figure it out. And one of the things that I remember thinking is the old models of education have really highlighted that those differences are the result of biological or genetic differences between races and ethnicities or these differences are the result of cultural differences between racial and ethnic groups. And none of that really made sense to me. And so that really started me on a journey where I started to understand that it has very little to do with any of those things and has everything to do with the environment, with what we call the social determinants of health, those factors where we live, learn, work, and play that impact our health, that these are the reasons why you see these huge differences. And just the very act of living in a neighborhood that is well-funded and well-resourced versus living in a neighborhood that is underfunded and under-resourced, that those things can lead more significantly to differences in mental health outcomes. And that's where we have to focus our interventions.
So that seems completely logical to me.
It does, yes.
So why was that ever in question? Why was that not ever just...
It's a great question. And I think it's because the people that had spent time in the field did not have the experience of what it's like to be in a neighborhood, to grow up in a neighborhood that is under-resourced and underfunded. Or they didn't have the experience of encountering and interacting with people outside of that clinical environment, interacting with people that are from those under-resourced and underfunded neighborhoods. And then, there is this big elephant in the room, which is structural racism. Mm-hmm. And it is so pervasive, this idea that our institutions have been built and created and have been set up to advantage certain populations and certain racial and ethnic groups and disadvantage others. And so that frame, medicine and psychiatry has operated in that frame since the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. And so we have passed those values on. The idea that we look at an illness or we look at a condition and we say that group has that condition because that group makes different choices, makes worse choices about their health, or that group has that condition because that group has a higher genetic predisposition to have this particular diagnosis or this particular problem, or even things like the belief that certain populations are more prone to use certain drugs when that's not been proven in any sort of way. So we've had all of these ideas and with that structurally racist frame that we all marinate in society, it's very easy to kind of err on the side of thinking that these differences have nothing to do with the social determinants and have everything to do with people's personal choices and individual decisions that they make.
I feel like that's a common, though less common than it used to be, story that's often told in Alaska, especially about Alaska Native people. And, Indigenous people are more prone to being alcoholics when it's just...
Exactly. Indigenous people and alcoholism is probably one of the most pervasive examples of mental health inequities, in which many studies have been done looking at genetic predisposition to try and find the gene that exists among Indigenous populations, or the gene that exists in Alaska Native populations that predicts higher rates of alcoholism, with no understanding or consideration for the historical trauma that has been visited upon Indigenous populations since the founding of this country. And the idea that that historical that trauma may in fact lead to, through historical epigenetics, may lead to gene changes. But really it is an environmental and a structural impact that leads to a coping or a self-medication through alcohol that is really driving this. And yet people want to say that this is some sort of biological or genetic influence, or that, again, Alaska Native populations or Indigenous populations are somehow just, they like alcohol better, or they make bad choices about substances, so they choose to use alcohol more than other populations. And none of that is really accurate, but it has been very pervasive in our society.
We're going to take a quick break, then be back with more Mental Health Mosaics from Out North.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
If you're hurting in your relationship or have been affected by sexual violence, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is a free 24/7 confidential and anonymous domestic, dating, and sexual violence helpline for Alaska Natives. Help is available by calling or texting 1-844-7-NATIVE or using the chat icon at strongheartshelpline.org. This message is sponsored by the Strong Hearts Native Helpline.
Welcome to Mental Health Mosaics, a project of Out North. I'm Ann Hillman. Dr. Ruth Shim is a psychiatrist who is working to end discrimination in the mental health care system. She says one of the other most pervasive and damaging lies in psychiatry relates to Black people and psychosis.
I think one of the clearest examples is thinking about schizophrenia and the ways that we think about schizophrenia as it relates to Black people. And so Jonathan, the author and psychiatrist Jonathan Metzl, wrote an incredible book on this called The Protest Psychosis: How Schizophrenia Became a Black Disease. And he really highlights how in around the 1960s, as we started to see the rise of the civil rights movement, the very definition of schizophrenia was kind of altered from this disease that mostly affected white women who were not operating in their appropriate gender roles. So they weren't taking care of their households appropriately, and they weren't cleaning and cooking as much as they should have been. And they would find themselves diagnosed with schizophrenia prior to the 1960s. And then with the rise of the civil rights movement, you saw a shift and a definition of a type of psychosis called the protest psychosis, where schizophrenia was kind of reformed by psychiatry into this condition that was that people were considered to be aggressive and hostile and violent and paranoid. And that really took off in the 60s and was really associated very particularly with Black people, and particularly Black men. And so the very act of championing civil rights, or the very act of trying to fight against oppression, was mislabeled in the minds of many white psychiatrists, was mislabeled as a psychotic illness. It's really complicated, because it's not even that it wasn't that there were there wasn't psychosis happening. So in some of those populations, there was psychosis happening, because stress induces psychosis. And so those men and women that were fighting for civil rights were under higher levels and higher rates of stress. And so they were, in fact, maybe some of them were having psychotic symptoms at times, but not because of the context by which it was defined, and not because of the act itself of protesting and fighting for civil rights. So what we saw in that time was really an erasure of context, a lack of understanding of how the socio-historical context by which somebody operates in dictates their behavior, and how behavior is natural and normal behavior could be pathologized to be seen as something, especially if you come from a place where you don't understand that context, that behavior could be pathologized and attributed, again, the hostility, the aggression. And so that happened in the 60s. And again, documented really well in the book, The Protest Psychosis, but that happened in the 60s. But what we have here in modern times, which has been really well studied by many researchers, including Steve Strakowski, is that we see inequities in all sorts of outcomes as it relates to people of color and Black people and schizophrenia. So Black people are more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia than with a mood disorder like bipolar disorder or depression compared to white people. And they're misdiagnosed. So they may have bipolar disorder and they're misdiagnosed as schizophrenia.
Can you help me understand, understand the differences between these two diagnoses and kind of, understand the differences in why it matters if you're given one versus the other.
So it matters a lot because of treatment options. So when you have a mood condition, the treatment is a mood disorder. The treatment is often very different from a primary psychotic disorder. And so if you're misdiagnosing the condition, you're often then providing the wrong treatment. And so if somebody is not getting the most effective treatment for their condition, then they're not going to improve. And so what you see is in this particular population, a misdiagnosis followed by then not the right management of symptoms. So a lack of improvement. And then you see these populations having, again, worse outcomes. So if you have misdiagnosed Black people at higher rates, then those people do not recover completely from their illnesses. And then we look at like rates of treatment responsiveness. And we say this particular population does not respond as well to this particular medicine or this particular therapy, when really what it came down to was that the diagnosis was wrong in the first place. But even beyond making a mistake in the diagnosis, we also see things like, again, associated with this conceptualization of aggression. We see things like Black people are more likely to be put in seclusion and restraints when they go to the hospital for emergency psychiatric care. They're more likely to be seen as hostile and aggressive. They're more likely to be given antipsychotic medications against their will to manage their behavior. And they're more likely to be given higher doses of those antipsychotic medications. So the management, in addition to the misdiagnosis, the management in crisis situations is more harmful. And a very clear example I can give you is from my personal clinical experience. I've had, there are many different medications that you can use to treat psychotic symptoms. But one of the medications, an older medicine, haloperidol, is a medication that back in the 60s, when they were very strongly associating Black people with aggression and psychosis and schizophrenia, there were ads that you started to see pop up in psychiatric journals, which showed a threatening, aggressive Black man. And the headline on that ad, the tagline on that ad said, "Aggressive, belligerent, cooperation begins with Haldol." And so what you've seen over time is that that particular medication somehow became associated in the minds of psychiatrists with that direct marketing with, this is the medication you use when a Black person presents with schizophrenia and is aggressive. And so that marketing was very effective because last year, one of my patients had to go into the hospital, and I have him on an antipsychotic medication, and he was doing reasonably well, but then he had a decline in his functioning, and he went into the hospital, and he was hospitalized in a psychiatric facility. And the first thing that the inpatient psychiatrist did was remove him from his medicine and start him on Haldol. And I thought to myself, why would that be the choice, the first choice, you know? And I certainly don't want to imply that this inpatient psychiatrist was racist, but I also think there was a clear connection there, because there is this connection in this drug works in this particular population. It would be fine if that was a one-off thing, but a year later, another patient of mine who is a Black woman also went into the hospital because she had a decline in her functioning, and she was taken off of her medication and put on Haldol. Now, that being said, I have several white patients that when they go into the hospital, they are not put on Haldol. So even today, we see these inequities kind of, you know, it's complicated because it's not like Haldol is a terrible medication, but it has side effects and it has, and there are things to be considered, and it's not first line anymore, really, all the time for like ongoing outpatient management of schizophrenia. And yet the only times that I've seen inpatient doctors prescribe that medication to my patients is when they are deemed to be aggressive or threatening, or when they're Black.
Wow. Even today.
Even today.
Like, it's not surprising, and yet it's still
shocking.
Yeah.
Even when it's not surprising, it's still shocking. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good distinction. Looking beyond, like, these are heinous things to happen to individuals, but when you're treating individuals, you're not just looking at an individual, you've got a whole family and a whole community. How do these beliefs then spiral out wider into communities?
Part of what happens is, we human beings are not islands. And so we do not operate independently. We operate within our family units. We operate within our communities. And I think that when one person has a negative interaction with the mental health system, that scars families and communities. So we know that, and I know from personal experience, you know, if you experience discrimination, if you experience mistreatment when you go for services or care somewhere, I have never returned to a restaurant that I ate at where I felt I was discriminated against. I've never once been like, okay, I'll go back there because it was probably a one time. I always think I have choices, I have options, and I don't need to go to that restaurant again. And so for mental health care, it's a little bit different. People go and they're mistreated and they may be discriminated against in healthcare settings. And they then have very limited options about like how do they re-interface with that setting. And so the damage that can be done, the damage that's done to one person, then ripples through that family. And so I spend a lot of time interacting clinically with family members who have been traumatized by watching their loved ones be harmed in seeking care, or be made to feel less than, or be discriminated against in their pursuit of mental health care at maybe some of the worst times in that family's life, when someone is in crisis and they need help, and they're made to feel less than, and they're made to feel not important and not valuable. And so that then causes a ripple effect, and then the whole family and the whole community tends to kind of turn away from seeking those services. And so that's when you end up with this this narrative that certain populations, certain racial and ethnic groups, Black and Latinx populations, for example, Indigenous populations, that they have so much stigma that they don't want to interact with the mental health system. And I'm not saying that stigma doesn't exist, and I'm certainly not saying, no, there is no stigma, but I actually don't think that the driving factor in minoritized populations or populations that have traditionally been oppressed, I don't think it's actually stigma. I think it's a very reasonable response to a system that has been harming individuals, and a desire not to willingly interface with a system that treats you like you're not worthy, or is more likely to put you in seclusion and restraints when you go for crisis help. You know, I think that it's a very reasonable thing not to want to interact with that system. So it's not a stigma problem as much as it's a general reasonable response to a trauma being elicited on you. And so then it's really important because the intervention is very different. So many times people say, oh, there's stigma in these particular populations. So we have to educate people on how important it is for them to seek mental health services and how important. And that is not where the emphasis needs to be. The emphasis needs to be on us improving the mental health system and to be providing culturally humble services and structurally competent and structurally humble services that values and appreciates people and makes them feel important and cared for. And if we fix the system to be more trustworthy, then people will engage with the system more. So it's not about educating, certain populations and saying, oh, you know, come to our healthcare system. It's the onus is on the providers and the people in the healthcare system to make it a better place for people to interact.
And you've done some work talking about specific ways that could happen. What are specific ways? Like how can we make the mental health care treatment system actually responsive to people in a more inclusive, I hate the word inclusive.
I like the word inclusive.
I feel like I've encountered so oftentimes people are like, oh, let's make it inclusive, but they don't really.
There's no action following the statement of inclusivity. Yeah, I hear you.
So that's what I mean. Like, how do we make it actually inclusive and mean it?
So I think there's many ways, and I think that the lack of inclusivity and real action behind that inclusivity has to do mostly with power. Mm-hmm. And power dynamics and who has power and who doesn't. And so if we start to kind of like tease that apart, we see systems that are designed to make it clear when people interface with those systems that the people who have power are powerful. And that the people who don't are made to feel less than. And so then the work becomes unraveling that hierarchy that we have created within our mental health systems. And that can happen on multiple levels. But I think the quickest way to get there is to have the people working in that system be the very people who are actively from those communities and members of those communities. That's when workforce diversity becomes most important because that is not the traditional ways that mental health clinics are designed. The mental health clinics do not traditionally reflect the demographics of the population that they're serving. And so it really does. So it's not just a matter of creating a more diverse workforce. It's truly having the people that work in that particular mental health setting be from the very community that they're serving and look and be those members of that community. And this is one of the reasons why I am so kind of supportive of the idea of peer specialists, because it is the very function of a peer specialist, to be a person from the community who has lived experience, who knows exactly what it feels like to go through this situation and to be able to provide that care and support. And that is the fastest way that we will make these settings, we will redesign these settings so that people can come in and feel valued and feel important, because they are the setting. They are the people that are in that setting. And so that's the work that we have to do. And that involves, across all levels, aggressively diversifying the workforce. And we talk about workforce shortages and all of that, but I think we need more psychiatrists of color. We need more psychiatrists from oppressed and marginalized backgrounds. We need more sociologists and social workers and psychologists and peer specialists from all sorts of backgrounds. And that is the way that we change the system and truly build an inclusive mental health system.
I'd like to delve a little bit more into, you kind of touched on people's lived experience and bringing that in and social determinants of health. I'd love to kind of talk more about what can be done or what you're advocating people within the mental health field to do to really account for all of these other factors that influence our mental health, as opposed to just seeing a therapist or a psychiatrist.
I think one of the best ways that people can start to take action is by increasing awareness. And so I think that the mental health field, as it's kind of currently structured, spends a lot of time thinking about the individual patient that sits in front of, comes to the office and sits down in front of them, and does an assessment that, again, doesn't have all of the context in place. And particularly the context that I think most providers miss when they do an evaluation on a client or a person with a mental health problem is that they're missing the structural components. They're missing that understanding of how those social determinants are interacting directly with that individual. Mm-hmm. So they're not understanding how access to healthy foods or how poverty or how adverse childhood experiences or how homelessness or housing instability, they're not always understanding or how discrimination and racism and sexism, how they're not always understanding how those things show up in people's lives. And they're not searching for it. They're not asking questions about that. So they're not asking people about their identities. They're not trying to understand like who this person is and how the external world has interacted with that person and who they are and who their identity is. And I think that if we as providers don't do that work, we're dropping the ball on taking care of whole people and moving them towards health and wellness. So the key and the first step is recognizing that when somebody comes and sits in front of you for an evaluation or for help and in managing their mental health, that they're not just some diagnosis or they're not just some condition, but they are like a whole person who brings multiple identities and multiple beliefs and multiple cultural identities to who they are. And that the job of the provider is to understand better that person's story and how they interact with the world and how the world interacts with that person. So some people talk about this in the concept of structural competence. And this is, again, Jonathan Metzl and Helena Hansen. Mm-hmm. This is work by Jonathan Metzl and Helena Hansen to think about how we talk about cultural competence. We talk about how it's important to understand that there are lots of different cultures and understand the groups that different cultures have different values. But part of what structural competence is saying is we have to better understand how all of those social determinants show up in people's lives. And we have to be better at identifying those social determinants and asking people about those social determinants and thinking about that context.
So to put this into terms that aren't using like structural competency or social determinants, like basically helping providers, but potentially also helping individuals understand like all of the different factors that are happening around them and how that influences them, from the stress of not having enough food to the stress of being discriminated against, to the stress of having to navigate complicated systems that weren't built for you to navigate.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Making sure that I could explain this the way it's supposed to be explained.
It's you explain it beautifully. And I think that's the key is that's not the model by which most psychiatrists are trained. Psychiatrists are trained to say, what are your symptoms? You know, how much have you, you know, what's your appetite been like? So like ask about appetite, because appetite is a symptom of depression and poor appetite is a symptom of depression. So ask if your appetite has changed, but not ask how easily can you access food? How easily can you access healthy foods? Do you have food insecurity? And so there's like a number of those symptoms. So lack of sleep is another symptom of depression. And so we ask those questions, how's your sleep? But we don't ask, is there like noise in your neighborhood that prevents you from sleeping? Is there, you know, are you witnessing violence? Are you experiencing things that are interfering with your sleep that aren't just, I have this symptom of insomnia? So it's really about, it's about going deeper and understanding how those environmental factors really do come into play when, and we are social beings that interact with our environment. It seems pretty obvious, right? Like we should be assessing how people interact with their environments and what's in those environments. And that is just as critical as just understanding and ticking off the symptoms of certain disorders and conditions.
This is going to sound like a really basic question, but I would love it if you could talk about, even just really quickly, like how discrimination directly affects mental health, just so that people like grasp that concept.
Yeah, that's not a basic question at all. It's a great question. When I was working on the book I edited, The Social Determinants of Mental Health, we were trying to gather all those determinants and look at their impact on mental health outcomes. And there was this really fascinating pattern that we were noticing when we were writing that book, because we looked at things like discrimination, we looked at housing, we looked at food, we looked at adverse childhood experiences, and there wasn't a lot of data out there at the time. And one of the things we noticed is that there was a lot of data that showed for almost all of those social determinants, there was a lot of data that showed that people have significant physical health problems associated with things like adverse childhood experiences and housing instability and food insecurity. And there was less data to support that there were mental health impacts. We found them, but they were harder to find. And it was like that for all of the social determinants except discrimination. So for discrimination, there was not a lot of evidence to show that discrimination directly led to poor physical health, but there was an abundance of information and lots of data that showed that discrimination leads to poor mental health outcomes. And specifically, certain diagnoses are directly correlated with being perceived as being discriminated against. So you actually don't even have to have been actively discriminated against. You just as an individual have to feel as if you were discriminated against. And that would lead to an increased risk of a number of mental health conditions, including major depressive disorder, alcohol use disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, more days of having psychological distress. All of those illnesses and all of those mental health conditions are tied directly to the experience of perceiving that you are discriminated against. And so there's a direct line there. And again, it's really powerful because that data is really robust data that we have on this. So absolutely, discrimination leads to poor mental health and leads to poor mental health outcomes. And we have really strong data that scientists have been working on for decades now that says that pretty definitively. So we can't fix all of the ills of society, but we could at least eliminate the discrimination that people experience when they go to seek health care and the discrimination that they experience when they get mental health care services. And again, one of the quickest ways we can do that is by diversifying the workforce, by making sure that there are more people from those same identities providing care, because it's less likely that somebody is going to be discriminated against by someone from the same group or category that they are in.
That was Dr. Ruth Shim talking about racism and mental health. As Dr. Shim said, there are ways to make the mental health system more equitable. Part of that starts with diversifying the workforce and valuing the skills and life experiences that peer navigators bring to the table. Providers also need to consider all of the different aspects of life that influence our mental health, like the resources we have access to and the environment we live in. This episode was edited by Susie Buchanan with audio editing by Dave Waldron. Our theme music is by Aria Phillips. I'm the show's host and producer, Anne Hillman. We receive funding from the Alaska Center for Excellence in Journalism, the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and the Alaska State Council for the Arts. You can find more resources related to mental health, as well as poetry, art, and even a workbook on our website, mentalhealthmosaics.org. Want to hear more of Mosaics? Subscribe to the podcast on any podcast app. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.